this too. I threw him down the stairs and so what are the options? It would help actually to just inform things if the people in the different universities could give me an idea of what the local deadlines are. Yeah. Let's say something about Lee or something about university. I'm not sure which. I see. So you think it's not very pressured. At some level, this is supposed to be a prototype for, you know, happy, harmonious, you know, interaction amongst universities. So it'd be hard. It's bad to get off on a wrong start. So it'd be useful if you guys. It's just every university has it. There's a marked deadline, and it's a question of what it is. So. Why don't we have the vote next week, and then in the meantime, I can find out for McMaster, but for Western and for Waterloo, if you just figure out what the actual date is. It is probably, I would guess, it's early January, because it's the very last exam, typically is very close to Christmas, and they give you over Christmas to mark it. So I imagine that's kind of roughly when we're talking about, and that'll be the... name because this is I've chosen to use Myra on a field. This is what's making the notation look strange. And that came in because the rule which I'm using, and which you'll see why I'm using later on, is that the electric charge for those particles is related to the third component of the eigenvalue of the third component of the SE2, which is plus or minus a half for these fields, plus hypercharge. And there are different conventions. Sometimes people call this hypercharge over 2, but I'm not. So sometimes people will give you hypercharges which are, instead of being a half here, they would have been 1, and things like that. There's a convention there. And so that's what I'm telling this, for now, just take it as being, you know, an interesting piece of numerology. But that's how I'm really choosing these y's. I'm choosing these y's for these fields, which had to be the same for both these guys because they were supposed to be transforming the same way. I'm choosing these y's in such a way that the electric charges are right for these two things. And you'll see that this is the combination that's going to be in front of the coupling constant for the massless photon, and that's why I'm calling electric charge. But it's not, that shouldn't be clear yet. That's how it's going to turn out. And you'll see later on why it turns out that way. But that's where when I give you these numbers, why, that's how I'm choosing them. So now for the quarks, we had up-type quarks, which were the up charm and top. The down-type quarks, which are the down, strange, and bottom. And again, we can split they all have electric charge now, unlike the neutrinos, which are neutral. And so they're each going to be different from their antiparticle. So each of those things should be represented by 2 Majorana fermions and 1 Dirac fermion, because their antiparticles are distinct from the particles. And so let me use this as the field that destroys the left-handed part. So and the same thing here, this would be the and then the corresponding, the analog, I need also something which is going to be destroying the right-handed part of those quarks, and let me call those things capital U. So I'm treating them differently because they transform differently under the group. And it's very similar to the story for SE2 and U1. It's very similar to what happened for the leptons. The left-handed guys transform together as a doublet so that you have transitions in the weak interactions between these things. When you have electrons can be destroyed and turned into neutrinos, there are reactions that do that. And similarly, there are reactions that take deep down-type quarks into up-type quarks. And so these things we're going to think of as being a doublet. But those reactions, so far as we know, only involve the left-handed particles and not the right-handed ones. And so these things will be singlets, and they won't transform under SU2, whereas these guys will be a doublet. And I'll call this doublet, together, QI, which is the up-type one is at the top, and the down-type one is on the bottom. And that's kind of why they're named the way they are. There might be, but no one knows what it is, yeah. Sorry? Yeah, string theory tells us all, yeah. Hallelujah. No, that's called the family problem, is why is there 3 generations? No one has a convincing argument yet. Take it as phenomenological. Yeah, this is a proposal which is going to describe the data really well, as you'll see when we calculate. And it's the fact that it's a gauge group isn't a surprise, but the fact that it's this gauge group there's no deep thing about that. So there are proposals to, instead of having this, maybe the real gauge group was SU5 or something, which would be one group which has this inside of it, and that would predict various things, but there's really no evidence, really no compelling evidence that any of those proposals are right. And that'll be one of the last topics is those. No, that's all spin one stuff. No. So let me just finish writing this down. So these guys are easier because they, you know, they're separately singlets under SE2. But we need, in this case, all these guys are going to transform under SE3. And so we need some sort of a, so we're expecting things to be in three component columns on which in a unitary 3x3 matrix can act. And so the thing I haven't told you yet is that for every one of these types of forks, they come in three copies. There's the three different colors of fork. So the upness, the charmness, and the topness is called flavor. So, and the electronness, muonness. And that's supposed to distinguish it from the color, which the quarks only carry and the leptons don't. So that you can really think of the quarks as carrying a second index, which I've used A and I've used alpha. So let's use something late in the alphabet, let's say Z. So Z here goes from 1, 2, and over three. You know, the thing is everything runs over three indices. There's three indices for color. There's three indices for number of generations or flavor. There's three indices you'll see later on for the historical SU3 flavor. But you can think of this as being, you know, red. Depends if you're, you know, if you're French, it's red, white, and blue. If your primary colors, it's, you know, cyan, magenta, and something else. I think in Europe they use red, yellow, and blue. I think it's the Americans that use red, white, and blue. It doesn't make any difference, really. It's just, you know, three colors. So you should really think that there's really three times as many things there as I had told you about before. And that's the thing which will, if you imagine writing the up quark, the specific up quark or the charm quark as a three-component column vector, the thing that labels the three components will be this new thing, color. And that's the thing that these 3x3 matrices will act on. And so it's completely independent of the upness or downness part, which we could have thought as being another label. Q could have be thought of to have three labels here. One, which is a family. So, you know, say up, charm, top. Another one is one which goes from 1 to 2, which tells you whether up, I'm talking about up or down. And then the third one would be color, which is going from, you know, over red, yellow, and blue. In fact, there's a fourth index, would be the Lorentz index, which is the thing which runs from 1 to 4, which is counting the components of a four-component spinner. And so you don't write them all, because otherwise you've got indices in your face, and it becomes hard to really read anything. But that's you keep in mind that these things are all independent of one another. And so I'm going to write the color index here, because I want to distinguish, in this case particularly, how color acts from how up and down acts. So let me say, God, I need another letter. What's another letter? C. So Z goes from 1, 2, and 3 is color. And C equals 1 and 2 is up or down. And I'm writing those explicitly this time because I want to explicitly write the SE3 matrix and the SE2 matrix, and so you can see that they're acting differently. And so for these ones, they wouldn't have the second index. So here we would have had UI, Z, and DI, Z without an up and down label, because they're not going to be in a two-component object. So the transformation rules here would be gamma left, say delta U, I, Z. So for SE3, we'll have, sorry? No, there's not one here, because you're thinking, why don't I just group these things and say psi goes from 1 to 2 here? But the thing is that the SU2, the gauge group SU2, is not going to relate these two things, but it will relate these two things. So we'll have I omega 3 alpha times the generator of which there are 8 for SU3, and it's a matrix in, you know, Z space, so ZZ prime times U I Z prime. And there's a complication here. I'm going to call this T bar because I'll come back to that. So this is the matrix which is representing SU3. And then we'll have plus I omega 2A times the matrix. I'll write as T bar A. Zero, sorry. there's no SU2 transformation because these things I never wrote it. That's the problem. I never wrote the transformation properties. So this is this transforms as a 3 under SU2. It's a doublet under 3 under SU3. It's a doublet under SU2, and it's got a hypercharge, which we can figure out because by the electric charges. This is supposed to have electric charge 2/3, and this is supposed to be minus 1/3. And so, if I subtract a half from 2/3, I would get 1/6, right? So this should be. Talking about this line here? Let's come back to that once I finish this, okay? Because it's part of what's making this complicated is something I haven't told you yet down here. So let me finish the thought down here first. So this is hypercharge 1/6 because 1/6 plus 1/2 would be 2/3, and 1/6 minus 1/2 would be minus 1/3, right? Right. Whereas this thing transforms, so I want to say, and this is going to be wrong, it's a three-dimensional representation of SU3, but because I've chosen the right-handed quarks transform in the same way as the left-handed quarks, and the right-handed antiquarks and the left-handed antiquarks transform in the complex conjugate representation. So if these guys are being chosen to be the ones that have the right-handed quarks, the right-handed piece transforms as an SU3 transformation. And so what I should really be doing is the simplest thing to write would be to write the right-handed transformation rule here. So I'm going to start this over again. So this is the left-handed piece transforms in the complex conjugate of the triplet representation, which is called the 3-bar. So if these guys transform with complex conjugate matrices, this is also transforming with complex conjugate matrices, but those are really the same representation for SU2, turns out. And the hypercharge here would be the same as the electric charge. Now the left-handed part of this field contains the up antiquark, and the up antiquark has electric charge minus 2/3. So that'll be minus 2/3. And here the down quark, it's also because it's an the left-handed field is destroying the antiquark, it's transforming in the complex conjugate representation. It's a doublet, and it has hypercharge plus 1/3, because that's the electric charge of the left-handed antiquark. So having said that, let me do the left-handed transformation of this. Oh, I lied. That's because the drugs are taking effect. Sorry. You want consistency. See, the real learning exercise is in taking the lies I tell you out of the truth I tell you. All right, incoming. Thank you. That's right. Those are singlets. So let me give you this one first. So this is the one that transforms under everything. So it's delta Q. There's a family index, and there's a color index. There's an SU2 index, and the SU2 index is just this one. So that'll be gamma left I omega 3 alpha. Now the generators of SU2 are conventionally written in terms of a standard set of matrices, much like the Pauli matrices, which I'll write out for you in a second. So I'll have lambda. They're called the Gell-Mann matrices, and they're matrices in color space, so they have indices z, z prime. That's the SU3 part of it. Then we have an SU2 part, which is exactly the same as it was for leptons. So it's Pauli matrix over 2, and that's a matrix acting in C space. So C prime And then there's a U1 hypercharge, and the hypercharge is 1/6. So we have plus I omega 1 times 1/6. So nobody acts on the flavor index. It goes along for the ride. Three copies of everything. And then the hypercharge doesn't act on either of these two indices. So that means everybody in a doublet or a triplet has exactly the same hypercharge. But the SE2 is mixing up this the two components that are labeled by U and V. And the SE3 is mixing up these three components corresponding to the three colors of each. Now, I'm going to give you the right-handed transformation of these fields because those are the ones that also are quarks rather than anti-quarks, so they'll have the same matrices. So the left-handed thing would be the complex conjugate of this. But it's just more convenient to tell you this here. So this is the same because they're both triplets. Well, except I was about to write down the left-handed part. That's why I changed. Is it it's going to be conceptually easier if I just write it the right-handed part? So what I started to write before was the left-handed part of the field, which will be the complex conjugate. But I'm writing the right-hand part just exactly so it would look like the one above. So then this is not here because it's a singlet. And then the hypercharge in this case is minus 2/3. And for the down quark field, it's the same thing. But the hypercharge is different now. Right, but that's exactly the right thing because the charge, the hypercharge, the convention for hypercharge is that we're always talking about the particle destroyed by the left-handed part of the field. So the rule for hypercharge is determined by the electric charge. The electric charge that we're talking about is always the particle destroyed by the left-handed part of the field. Oh, and so you're saying that this is the right-hand part, so it's the opposite. Yeah, you're right. Thank you. So this hypercharge is the same always. It's just that the rule for the right-handed things is the complex conjugate. Well, it would have been if these guys, if I had defined the lambdas to be the way that the left-handed field transformed. But the left-handed field transforms under the complex conjugate, which has all those signs in it. So this thing is defined to transform the same way this one does. So if I had written down the left-handed piece, let me write down the left-handed piece. So the delta, so gamma left delta UZI would be gamma left minus I omega 3 alpha lambda alpha star over 2 z prime. So this follows from that, right? So I need to tell you what the lambdas are. So these lambda alphas, you remember what the Pauli matrices were. The Pauli matrices, I just remind you because it's going to be useful when I write these other ones down. So the tau 1 was this. Tau 2 was 0 minus I 0. And tau 3 was 1, 0, 0, minus 1. So the deal with the lambdas, the lambdas have to be Hermitian, and they have to, you know, the idea is that these matrices, an arbitrary 2x2 unitary matrix could be written as e to the I omega a tau a over 2. That's kind of why these, so in a 2x2 unitary matrix, this being unitary meant that tau had to be Hermitian. This had to have determinant 1 because it was SU2 and not U2, and that means that tau has to be traceless. So you're looking for a traceless Hermitian 2x2 matrix, So there's four Hermitian 2x2 matrices, and the traceless condition makes them three. So there's a basis. There's three standard Hermitian matrices you can use, and so this is here they are. They're linearly independent because you know this one's antisymmetric, that one, these two are symmetric, that one's diagonal, that one's not. And so all I have to do now for SE3 is the same kind of thing. So for SE3, there's a similar story that that if we had an arbitrary 3x3 unitary matrix here, it's the exponential of I times a 3x3 Hermitian matrix, and the fact that this has got unit determinant means that this has zero trace. So I'm looking for traceless 3x3 Hermitian matrices. There are nine. You know, basically the Hermitian condition makes there's a 3x3 complex matrix has nine complex parameters in it. The Hermitian condition cuts it down to nine real parameters. The traceless condition gives me eight. So there's going to be eight real Hermitian, sorry, not real, eight Hermitian traceless matrices, and I can choose a standard basis like this one that's conventional, and that's called the Gell-Mann basis. So these are the Pauli matrices. These are the Gell-Mann matrices. And it's just a conventional choice. So let me just write them down for you. So the first three are the Pauli matrices in the upper left 2x2 block. So lambda 1 is 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. And lambda 2 is 0 minus I0, I0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. Lambda 3 is 0, I'm sorry. 1, 0, 0, 0, minus 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. So now we're looking for five more. One of them can be made diagonal, right? Because we can always make something a unit matrix in the top left block here and then give it a different eigenvalue here. That'll arrange for it to commute with this one, but it'll also be traceless. I can just choose the coefficients to be traceless. And so that one, now I'm going to use, there's also convention here. The convention we're going to use is that the trace, so lambda 8 is going to be a number times 1, 1, minus 2. 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. The 1 and 1 were chosen so it'll commute with all these guys that are the first three. And then the minus 2 was chosen to make it traceless. Now I'm going to choose an overall normalization because there's a conventional normalization choice that I've been making that everybody makes that no one ever tells you about. So the Pauli matrices have the property that trace of tau A, tau B is 2 times delta AB. So the convention for the Gell-Mann matrices is the same. We're going to choose the trace of lambda A, lambda alpha, lambda beta is twice delta alpha beta. And so in particular, the trace of lambda squared is 2. So you can kind of see now what this number has to be. If I take a lambda, trace of lambda 8 squared, I'll just do that over here. If I have a number, let's call it C, I would have had C squared times, 1 plus 1 plus 4. So that's 6 C squared. That's supposed to be equal to 2. So C has to be 1 over root 3, right? Is that right? Now the remaining things, and now we're missing lambda 4, lambda 5, lambda 6, lambda 7. So this diagonal one is lambda 8 conventionally. It's the last one. And what these things are just going to be the same as these off-diagonal guys, the 1, 1, and I minus I. But instead of mixing the first two rows, the 4 and 5 will mix the first and third row, and 6 and 7 will mix the second and third row. So this will be 0, 0, 1, first and third. Yeah, 0, 0. So those are them. They're all explicitly Hermitian. They're all explicitly traceless, and they all satisfy that particular condition because they're all basically Pauli matrices. So in particular, you're going to see, you know, you remember, well, I guess we'll come back to that. I'll come back to the significance of when things are diagonal or not later on. So now you know how these things transform under the gauge symmetry. The fermions transform. And so that means that you also know how to construct the gauge covariant derivative. So you remember the statement that if we had a field delta phi, which is I omega alpha T alpha phi, then the thing that was covariant was d mu phi was partial mu phi minus I a alpha mu T alpha phi. And covariant means that this had the property that the transformation rule for this is the same as it was for phi. So the thing involving that where A shifts by a derivative of something was canceling the thing where this differentiates the same parameter in the transformation of phi. And what's left then is just an overall matrix coming from the transformation of phi and the homogeneous part of the transformation of A. So that's kind of the definition of the covariant derivative. It's the derivative that transforms the same way that phi does. So it's easier to construct covariant things out of it or invariant things out of it, like you're going to want to do for the action. So you know the transformation rules here. So you can just read off the covariant derivatives. So d mu, let's do the, so let me write it out explicitly just once. So do we have to? Let's just always do the left-handed part. So we know the left-handed part of transformation here was, so this only had a hypercharge piece, right? So it was, and the hypercharge in this case was plus one. Let me write that somewhere. So let's write, let me write that here. So the bottom line was that we had a right-handed lepton, which was a singlet with hypercharge one. We had a left-handed doublet of leptons, which was a singlet, a doublet with hypercharge minus a half. We had an up-type quark, which I'm going to suppress the color index on now again, which is a triplet, a doublet, no, sorry, singlet. And I had hypercharge minus two-thirds. We had a right-handed down quark, which was a, sorry, this is an anti-triplet. Anti-triplet, singlet, hypercharge one-third. Then we had a left-handed set of quarks, which was a triplet, a doublet, hypercharge one-sixth. So the left-handed part of the covariant derivative of this guy is just going to be, well, let me first write the left-handed part of the transformation rule, just remind you. In fact, let me do the right-handed part. Oh, that's, I did left-handed part last time. So it was hypercharge 1. So it was I omega 1e. So the covariant derivative and the right-handed part, I can get my complex conjugating this. So if you like gamma right d mu ei will be gamma right d mu ei plus I omega 1. And these together, if I add this to this, then the gamma left plus gamma right is 1. That means that d mu ei is partial mu ei minus I omega 1 gamma left minus gamma right EI. And gamma left minus gamma right is just gamma 5. So that gamma 5 might have surprised you. And that's coming about because the left-handed piece is transforming in Fickner way. The right-handed one is always complex conjugate because it's a Majorana field. And so if I tell you what's happening with one, you can figure out the other one just by complex conjugate. Yeah. This one here? Yeah, there's a bar there. Yeah, no, there's a three bar. Okay, so now if you just do the same exercise here, I won't repeat both of them. Let me get rid of the right-handed one now, just because I made that point. So the gamma left p mu l I is going to be partial mu l I. The hypercharge is a minus a half, so we have a plus 1/2 plus I over 2 omega 1 l I. And then the doublet part is going to be minus I over 2. Oh, I forgot the gauge field. So we'll have, so I need to have a convention as to what we're going to call a gauge field. So let's conventionally we'll call B mu is the U1 hypercharge gauge field. So I have to have that here too. Because remember the gauge field appeared here. And then for the SE2 part, we have minus I over 2. And we don't need an omega. God, I'm done. The gauge parameter appears in the transformation law, but it doesn't appear in the covariant derivative. It's replaced by the gauge field. So I'm just doing this stupidly. I replaced omega 1 with B mu, both these places. And I have to do the same thing for the SE2 transformation. I don't have an omega 2 here. I have a gauge field for the SE2 part of things, which I'll call A alpha. I can't remember what I wrote this in the. Why don't I call this W? Let me just make sure I just use the same notation as I use in the notes. W. So these are the SE2 gauge fields, and then that's it, because there's no U1 here. Similarly, if I did the left-handed quark, so the hypercharge in this case is 1/6, so I've got minus I over 6 p mu q. And the SU2, it's a doublet, so it's minus I over 2 w a mu tau a q. And then for SU3, it's a triplet, so we have minus I over 2. Let's call the field in that case G for gluon. Alpha mu lambda alpha. So you see that for every generator, there's a different gauge field. And so the off-diagonal ones, you know, if we actually wrote this thing out, the SU2 thing out, for instance, let me write that out actually explicitly. So W A, you know, Pauli matrix A times, you know, L I. L I is really, you know, neutrino I, electron I. And so if I write this out as a matrix, W1 multiplies the matrix, which is has a 1, 0, 1, 1, 0. It's the first Pauli matrix. W1 mu. W2 multiplies the matrix 0 minus I, I 0, so that'd be a minus I W2 mu plus I W2 mu 0. And W3 multiplies the diagonal matrix, which is 1 in the top left, and it's minus 1 in the top right. So if I do the matrix multiplication, you can kind of see that these guys, you know, if I'm going to get W3 times mu I, and I'll get plus W1 mu minus I W2 mu EI. In the lower slot, I'm going to get minus W3 mu EI plus W1 mu I W2 mu EI. So what the off-diagonal ones are doing is they're changing the position of these things in the doublet. And we're going to then, in the action, combine that with fermion bar, so that the W1 and W2 are going to go with a term in the Lagrangian, which is going to involve a neutrino multiplying an electron, whereas the diagonal ones are going to involve W3 will multiply a neutrino with a neutrino or electron with an electron. So whether the matrix is diagonal or not is telling you whether the corresponding gauge boson appears in the Lagrangian with a term which changes the fermion from an up to a down or from one color to another color. That's the physical significance that you'll see comes from these matrices. So that's the covariant derivatives. And there's two more for these guys, which you can do with the same rules. Now, the other thing we needed was the transformation rules of these gauge fields. Remember, those were, so delta, under gauge transformations, B shifts by the derivative of omega. Ah. Now there's a conventional point I have to get straight. I told you this normalization convention that I erased here already. When I said this, the choice was that these things were satisfying a normalization condition that trace of the generators of two generators was 2 or 1 or a half or something. If I make that choice, then I have to be careful about the normalization of these terms, because When I was writing down this general, when we talked earlier about the general gauge transformations, someone asked, you know, why don't I have a coupling constant here? And I told you then that I could always absorb them into the generators. But if I absorb them into the generators, then that's going to change that normalization condition. So if I make that, as soon as I make that normalization condition, I have to now be careful that I'm no longer free to put coupling constants in here. So if I'm going to stick to the normalizations that I've chosen here, I need to multiply everybody by a coupling constant. So here I have I'll have a coupling constant for every group of G1, G2, G1, G2, G3. If you look back at what I did when I were doing quantum electrodynamics, I didn't have any coupling constants here. But when I gave you this rule, I had 1 over E here. So I had a coupling constant here. And that's because if you take this rule, I can always define a new B to be this times this and call that B prime. Then there's no coupling constants here. But then that'll appear in this rule. So you have a choice as how do you normalize the generators, how do you normalize the gauge field. But once you've made a choice, you're done. And so I'm trying to be consistent here now that I've actually given you explicit matrices for these generators, like I have over there. That's really made my choice as to what I'm allowed to do now for the normalization of these fields. So because of that, I've got the freedom to put a constant in front of all these gauge couplings. And I have to, yeah. Yeah. No, that wouldn't be invariant under the symmetry. And that's so. The freedom, the relative normalization of these two terms is completely set by these choices of these hypercharges. Yes, so a constant times this, and this is the constant. But it's the same constant in both cases, because I've already put in the hypercharge. If you started putting in different numbers in all these different places, then that would be like saying they have random unrelated hypercharges. And if you actually tried to
I just thought that the H1
is defined. No, yeah. And I'm pausing here because I misspoke. When I said the things were not invariant, you know, you could always define, if you put random couplings in here, that would be like taking random charges here. And the only penalty would be that you wouldn't have the right electric charges at the end of the day. But it would be invariant under the symmetry mathematically. All right, so you remember the general rule for gauge. I should write the general before I do the special one. The general rule for how the gauge fields transform, if you want this to be, this rule follows from this definition and this transformation if the gauge fields also transform in a specific way. And that was set in terms of the structure constants of the group, where these C's were defined by, you take the generators that are appearing over here, these T's, you take the commutator, and that was I times some coefficients. Yeah, some linear combination of the generators again. So knowing the T's tells you everything. The T's, you commute them, you find the C's. The C's are the thing that's in the transformation rules for the gauge fields. So if I apply that to the, that's all dictated now by the group structure. So we know the gauge group is SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. You know what these matrices T are. It's these things for SU3. It's the Pauli matrices for SU2, you know, over 2. And then the U1 is just some number. It's a unit matrix, if you like. And so for the U1s, if I have two U1s here, they commute. I have 0 on the right-hand side. And I take a U1 with anybody else in SU3 or SU2, they commute because of the rules I've given you how they act on the particles. So in the U1 case, everybody's 0 on the right-hand side. Sorry, you always have the inhomogeneous term, right? You always have that piece which is required by Lorentz invariant. And this was the thing that came in if you had a non-abelian group. If these things didn't commute, we had to have a piece which was homogeneous as well. So for U1, none of this is here because these C's are all 0. For U1, it commutes with everybody. So the U1 transformation is just d mu U1. The SU2 transformation will be, you know, d mu omega 2. But then we have the structure constants for these Pauli matrices. And if you work out the Pauli matrices, they satisfy, you know, tau A over 2 with tau B over 2 satisfy the rotation group's structure constants. So epsilon A, B, C, tau C over 2. So we have plus epsilon A, B, C. So the only thing that appears here is an SU2 transformation because SU2 and SU3 transformations commute with each other. They're acting on completely different labels. The color label is different from the up-down label. So you can multiply those matrices independently and they commute completely. So SU3 commutes with SU2. That's what it means to have a product group, you know, SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. Is that the groups separately commute with each other. All the failure to commute is within one group. So on the transformation rule for the U1 guy, you only have the U1 parameter. Transformation rule for the SU2 gauge field, you only have the SU2 transformation parameters. And same thing for the gluons. The transformation rule for the SU3 gauge field is going to only involve omega-3. And there's a bunch of structure constants which are called, you know, conventionally called F alpha beta gamma. Yeah, it's just because, not in this case, nothing, no. Because in the special case of SU2, I'm raising it with a unit matrix. There's no distinction really between the complex conjugate transformation and the representation itself. And in the case of a doublet, there's a matrix involved, but for the triplet, there's really not even a matrix involved. So remember, this told us, this was required with these transformation rules like this, things like this, to make these things covariant. And you can kind of see explicitly now. Oh, except that I've lied to you now. So let's check it. If I do this transformation here, I'm going to get a derivative of omega, but I've got a g here. So for that to be canceled by the transformation of b, I need, this is the convention where I need a 1 over g. 1 over G2. Now it's true that the derivative here cancels the derivative of omega here. And then the rest of it has no G's. And that's fine, too, because then that means that there's no, that just makes the transformation of E and B combine into something. This transformed like a, better example would be, this transforms like a doublet. And this transforms like a triplet, but the product of the two things is transforming like a doublet again. That's what the Pauli matrix is doing. And so, see, if I'd scaled G into B, then that would be like multiplying G through here. Then I would not have something on the right-hand side, but then I would grow it here. So you have the freedom of if I had not written the G's here, I could have not written them here, but then I have to have the G here. So I'm trying to be careful about the normalization, so it's what I'm telling you is consistent. Well, the G's themselves will, because I'm doing this all, and I'm using fields which are going to be canonically normalized. So I've actually used the freedom. I'm not free to scale the B's anymore, because when I write the kinetic term, I'm going to choose it to be canonical. And so if I was going to allow myself the freedom to rescale the B's by and the W's and the G's, that would mean that in the kinetic terms, I would pick up, when I wrote F mu nu, I'd have a constant up front, which is a parameter. And if you like, you can always do that. The gauge invariance allows you to always combine the G's into the B's, and then it'll come out in the kinetic term. And that's one way of seeing why the gauge fields always couple with the same coupling to everybody, because in one way of writing the fields, it's only appearing in the kinetic term for the gauge field. So it's very much like Newton's constant. Everybody couples universally because of the symmetry. So the gauge field strengths that are covariant under this, I'll write as B mu nu is just, this is like electromagnetism. There's nothing fancy here. But this one will have pieces W A mu nu. We'll start off as a curl. And then there's a piece which is if I've done this right, this will be invariant. See, so what happens now is that this term here with the 1 over g times the derivative, that will give me a piece here with the derivative of parameter times w and with the g's gone. And that'll cancel the derivative that you would have gotten here when if I plug this term into the derivative piece, the derivative acts on omega 1. And so the g here is being dictated by the g here, which is being dictated by the g's over there. Similarly, and these Fs, given these matrices, you can figure them out. You just multiply, take the commutators, and see which ones are non-zero. And you can look them up in tables if you really want to know. So now we have the punchline. So now we can write down the most general gauge invariant Lagrangian. And it's really simple, and there's no parameters in it. Given this gauge group, the only parameters in the problem are these g's. so there's G1, G2, and G3. That's not quite right, but I'll tell you why in a second. But it's almost right. So you remember what the gauge invariant Lagrangian was supposed to be? It was a bunch of kinetic terms for the gauge fields. So minus 1/4 B nu nu, B nu nu. Minus 1/4 WA, mu nu, WA, mu nu. Bunch of kinetic terms for the fermions. So we'll have minus 1/2 because they're Majorana. So who do we have? We've got E bar I, D slash EI. Now I'm sorry about this, D's from hell term here. You have to, by context, distinguish the D the field from D the derivative. And then minus 1/2. So the only other thing we were allowed to do with spin 1/2 only, or spin 1, was to write mass terms for the fermions. So you might have imagined we could have written down, you know, minus, you know, maybe E bar I gamma left EJ plus complex conjugate or something like that. But this actually is not allowed by the gauge invariance, right? So I chose this one because it's particularly simple. This thing only transforms under the U1. So you remember that gamma left EI, the infinitesimal version of the transformation is over here. Right, but the finite version of it would be that gamma left EI goes to e to the I omega 1 gamma left EI. So this is, it goes to e to the I omega 1 EI. But you remember, there's various ways to think about this, but this is the right-handed piece complex conjugated, or is it the left-handed piece transposed because these are Majorana? So this is, remember when we did the we did a general redefinition of fields at one point, the last class, where we said gamma left, if gamma left I went to some matrix MIJ, gamma left psi j, the mass term went to something like capital M transpose M capital M, right? That was something which I used to simplify what the mass term was. And it was a transpose here, not an adjoint. And that was because you could either think of this as being the left-handed piece transposed because of the Majorana condition, or it's the right-handed piece. If you thought of this as being dagger times beta, the thing that was surviving the beta, given the gamma left here, was a gamma right. So it was the right-handed piece complex conjugated times the left-handed piece. But the right-handed piece transformed as a complex conjugate as a left-handed piece. So if I complex conjugate it again, this thing transformed is exactly the same way as this does. So E bar I gamma left also goes to E to the I omega 1. E bar I gamma left. So this thing is not invariant. It goes to E bar I gamma left EJ goes to E to the 2 I omega 1. E bar I, sorry, EI. Or EJ, I guess they're, it's just a phase. It's a, each of these is transforming the same way. So it's not invariant. Under U1 hypercharge. So we can't write that down because it's not invariant. And if you look at all the other mass terms you can write down, they're all forbidden for the same, for one of those. Hypercharge kills them. I think hypercharge actually kills them all. So that makes it simple. So there's no parameters in the masses, because you can't write any masses, because the gauge symmetries forbid it. And that's it. So that's the whole story. The lie to the story is that I could have also really written something of the form epsilon mu nu lambda rho times a parameter theta times, say, G alpha, mu nu, G alpha lambda rho. And for electromagnetism, this kind of a term would have been a total derivative, and we wouldn't have written it down. So if we've written down epsilon mu nu lambda rho b mu nu b lambda rho, you could write this as being d mu of something, d mu of epsilon something. Don't know. Don't care what it is. And so there's a similar statement here, but it's a more subtle statement that there are configurations where the boundary terms that you would get from the total derivative are important. So these kind of terms, if they were there, you would know they were there. And experimentally, this parameter has to be less than or of order 10 to the minus 9, as we'll talk about in great detail later on. So this kind of thing could have been there. It would have been renormalizable if it was there. And it's the one thing that could have been in the standard model that's not, as far as we know. And so that's why I said it's there's only, saying there were three parameters was almost true. And the almost part is that there's really a fourth parameter that I could have written down, which I'm not writing down. But I'm just flagging to you now, but we'll come back to it later on. Right, so I'm kind of heading towards, so far there's been no Higgs boson, and that's because no one's ever seen a Higgs boson, but I'm trying to set you up for why you need one. So that if you don't have one, there is no mass. No, I didn't mean to say that. No, I think I remember what the conversation now. If that's what you're asking, then I didn't mean that. No, it's they get their mass. They require SC2 cross C1 to be broken before they can get a mass. And so in that sense, they do require the Higgs boson to have a valve to get a mass. So there's three parameters, G1, G2, G3. We can do this, you know, there's no issue with the scalar fields here. So if we minimize the energy, it's very simple, because these electric and magnetic fields are going to want to be minimized by zero. The fermions, you know, they're for fermions, so you can't populate their states multiply. And so if we want to write this as being an unperturbed piece plus an interacting piece, it's obvious what the interactions and the perturbations should be. L0 will just be, basically, L0 will be L in the limit that G1, G2, and G3 are all zero. And then L int is the rest. Because all the things that are not, if I plug these definitions in, the things that are not quadratic in these fields are all proportional to one of these G's. So when I square this, it's always this times one of these things, or this times itself, that's not quadratic. And so that's got a G in front of it. And in the covariant derivatives, we have two fermions. So the things that are not quadratic are all the things that involve these, whenever a gauge field appears in the covariant derivative, and they all explicitly have the G's in them. So perturbation theory, in this case, if we're dividing things into a quadratic piece and not quadratic pieces, is being controlled by the smallness of G1, G2, and G3. Turns out that at the energies accessible at LEP, say, so at the energies where the things are colliding at around 100 GeV, all these couplings are small, and in particular, G3 is also small. So perturbation theory is actually a good approximation. And so if we wanted to read off what L0 is, it's just kinetic terms for everybody, right? So nobody has any mass at all. So that would say that in perturbation theory, everybody's massless and interactions are there. But the zeroth approximation should be that we've got massless things. And that wasn't a good approximation if you think of what the masses of these particles were. These things, you know, had the W boson and the Z boson had very heavy masses. The top quark is very heavy. So something's missing. It's all very simple and elegant. And actually, these interactions that are in here are the, so all the things that are buried in here are the ones, these are the interactions that are extremely well tested, because we know a lot about the couplings of the Z boson and the photon to fermions, as we'll see later on. So this picture that's so simple is actually a very good picture of the interactions, but it sucks when it comes to the masses, because it predicts they're all zero. And that's kind of what was the big, you know, gauge theories were discovered in the mid-50s, and they weren't really used for the first time successfully until the late 60s, and those 15 years were to do with this mass problem. And so the resolution is like in the scalar electrodynamics that I talked about before doing the standard model. What we're looking for is something like that scalar field, which can give get an expectation value in the background and break the symmetry. Because the essence of what's going on here is that we have a symmetry which is relating all these particles, and they're all being related to zero. So the photon was massless. We wanted it to be massless. That's the one success. But then the W and the Z boson are being tied to the photon by symmetries. And so generically, symmetries don't change the masses of particles unless the ground state is not invariant. And so nothing here is causing the ground state to be fail to be invariant under the symmetries. So we should be expecting to find all the particles have the same mass, and in particular, they have zero mass. So the way around this problem is to have the vacuum not be invariant under SU2 cross U1. And so that's the trick. So what we know is that something has to break SU2 cross U1. What is it? And the standard model is the simplest choice. And as soon as the piece of the standard model that has all the parameters in it and is the least understood is, and the one that we're going to learn the most about in experiments to come, is the sector that's breaking the SU2 cross U1 symmetry. Because all the masses and all the ugly parts of the model are to do with that. And the corresponding particles haven't been discovered yet. So you get masses. So because SU2 cross U1 invariance implies massless particles, which ensure that the vacuum or the ground state but because we want the photon to be massless, we don't want to break all the generators here. We want to have one combination of these transformations preserve the vacuum. Because the photon, we like the fact the photon's massless. That's the goal. So the simplest choice is what the standard model is. And that's to choose a doublet, a scalar field, and would have it transform as a singlet under SU3, because we don't want to break SU3. We'll have it transform as a doublet under SU2, because that's the smallest thing it could be, and that's the simplest thing. And we'll have to give it a hypercharge. We want somebody in this doublet, so this phi, the doublet is, we write as being phi 1, phi 2. One of these fields we want to be electrically neutral, because we want it to be electrically neutral, and that's the field we want to be able to have be non-zero in the background. But we want it to be electrically neutral because we don't want to also break the U1 electromagnetism, which is going to make the photon massless. So you remember that the choice I was using was the electric charge is given by the eigenvalue of T3 plus the hypercharge. And so that'll tell us what the hypercharge has to be. So the hypercharge of the top thing is 1/2. And the bottom thing is, so the T3 of the top thing is 1/2. And this is minus 1/2. If we want to make this one massless, or chargeless, sorry, we should give it a hypercharge of plus 1/2. And that'll arrange that this one is neutral.
And this one will become charge plus one.
We could have also chosen minus 1/2, in which case that would be the one that was neutral, and this would be plus 1/2. And that basically corresponds to taking the complex conjugate and multiplying by a matrix. So it's not really an independent field. So with that choice, the transformation rule for phi is going to be no SE3 transformation, the standard doublet SE2 transformation, where the doublet, the Pauli matrix acts on this two-component thing. And then there's a hypercharge of 1/2. So it's minus or plus I over 2 omega 1 phi. So that means that the covariant derivative, we can write down, is partial mu phi minus I over 2 ua mu tau a phi minus I over 2. And there's a bunch of things we can now add to the Lagrangian. And that'll be where I'll stop. So we can write down a kinetic term for phi. Phi has to be complex because it's got a symmetry transformation which involves multiplying by I. So we'll have d mu phi dagger d mu phi. We can write down a potential, which is we want to be SE2 invariant, mu1 invariant. And that's, so let me just write it as being minus lambda over 4 phi dagger phi minus v squared squared. So all I've done is I've chosen the constant so that this thing is minimized at 0. And otherwise, I've written down a phi dagger phi squared term, a phi dagger phi term, with a negative coefficient so that phi will prefer to not be 0. And then I've chosen the constant term to make the minimum of 0. And that's the most general quartic thing I can write down. You'll show in one of the assignments. And then the couplings I can have between these things and these things all come down to your Pauli couplings, right? So I can have minus. So I need to know what it's possible to. Let me just write your Pauli couplings because we're going to run out of time. So one of the things you could do between now and next week is think about what kind of coefficients, what kind of Pauli couplings can I write down which are consistent with the symmetries of the problem. We're looking for things involving pairs of fermions and one scalar, but it has to be an SE3 singlet, it has to be an SE2 singlet, all the indices should contract, and it has to have no net hypercharge. And the bottom line will be that just like in the scalar electrodynamics case, the pieces in here involving two gauge fields in the derivatives are going to become masses for the spin 1 particles once we replace phi by its minimum. And the things in here involving, for instance, there'll be pieces like L bar, gamma left, E phi, stuff like that, or phi star. And so when phi gets replaced by V, a constant value, this will be a mass term for the electron and not the neutrino. And there'll be similar things involving Q, U and Q and D, which will give mass to the quarks. But there's a whole bunch of coupling constants that can appear in here because there's a generation index here, generation index here, and so we can have coefficients G, I, J here. And so as soon as you write a scalar, you introduce a whole bunch of parameters. And they're going to be related to the masses and the coupling constants, but it's nowhere near as predictive as this sector was. Everything we know about electroweak interactions is captured by the gauge couplings here that have three parameters in them. And that's not true for the scalar sector. It's much more ugly. So I'll pick that up next week. So the next class is just doing what you've done already in these toy models in chapter one for this specific model. So we'll write these things down more explicitly. We'll just write out the quadratic pieces after we've shifted phi by to the minimum of the potential. And then it's just a matter of being a good bookkeeper and just laboriously keeping track of who's quadratic in the expansion around that minimum and identifying all the quadratic terms and reading off what all the masses are as functions of these various coefficients and taking the freedom to diagonalize the masses as much as we can. Don't let Werner leave without me. I'll be there in a sec. I'm coming back with you.